PPI.org.
And thank you for joining Disability in Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. And my name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Hello, Charlene.
Good evening, everyone, and happy pledge.
And Annie Harvey is my engineer. Thank you so much, Annie. And tonight, of course, is pledge night. And you can do that by going to kfai.org/support. Or you can call 612-375-9030, and somebody is manning the phones, and we don't want him to get lonely. So go ahead and use the phones. And tonight we have a guest with us, Melissa Allman. Melissa is an advocacy and government relations specialist for the Seeing Eye School of Guide Dog Training, and she is with us, and we're going to be talking about the recently adopted and implemented U.S. Department of Transportation final ruling of traveling by air with service animals. So hopefully that all made sense to everyone. And am I coming through okay, Annie? I must be. Charlene, you can hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound good. Okay. You're good.
All right, excellent. Well, thank you for joining us tonight. Melissa?
Hello.
Hi. Thanks a lot. I want to start out by, giving people a little bit of a history on you and how you came to the Seeing Eye. Could you start out with that, please?
Absolutely. So I was matched with my first and current Seeing Eye dog, Luna, who is a Yellow Lab Golden Cross. And I was matched with her. It was 4 years ago on February the 1st. So that was a pretty exciting anniversary to celebrate. And at that time, when I was matched with Luna, I was living in Chicago and practicing fair housing law at that point. I'd been living there for a little over a year. And I continued to be there and do my thing in Chicago until I found out about this amazing job. You know, I was litigating and I was thinking I'd like to do more focused work on advocacy related to people with service animals, but there just didn't seem to be a niche for that. And then suddenly there was this awesome job at the Seeing Eye that opened up for advocacy and government relations specialist. So I applied and I am honored and privileged to say that I have been working at the Seeing Eye now for, it will be 3 years at the end of April.
Ah, congratulations.
Thank you.
And you do a very nice job, by the way, too. I have sat in meetings listening to you speak, and you do a great job.
Well, thank you.
So I want to talk about the advocacy and government relations specialist. So what exactly does that mean? And what kind of things are you responsible for knowing?
So what I do a number of different things. One of the things that I do is I provide our graduates with assistance when they either need information about their rights in various contexts like public access or housing or air transportation in terms of traveling around with our, with their guide dogs. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that I do. I provide information and resources. I, even though I am a lawyer, technically. I'm not practicing law in my job, so I can't provide actual legal advice, but I can provide information about the laws, which means that I'm responsible for knowing as much as I can about the Americans with Disabilities Act, Department of Justice implementing regulations, also the Department of Transportation regulations, the Air Carrier Access Act, and also about guide dog protection laws in various states, or at least having enough information that I can guide our graduates as they seek that information. And then sometimes I do connect people with ways that they can get legal assistance when they've exhausted other options and they need to take legal action. I also maintain our resources. So we have a portfolio of resources on our website at cni.org/access concerning the legal rights and information. And I maintain those resources and keep them as up to date as possible. And I also do some work around legislative and policy initiatives. Sometimes a graduate will say, hey, we're trying to strengthen our guide dog protection law, or in a case that we have right now, hey, we would really like to have a guide dog protection law in Maryland to help protect us from interference. Can you help us track that and be supportive of that legislation? And so things like that will come up.
It sounds like you are extremely busy.
It's a fun job. And I do trainings and outreach. They've been all on Zoom but for the past year, but they used to be in public and I used to travel places and do things like that.
Back in the good old days, right?
Yes.
But you know, I will have to say that Zoom has provided us with some good things too.
I'm extremely grateful for it. I really, really am grateful for it, for sure.
So I want to get to the meat of our conversations, but before we do, I do want to let everyone know that it is indeed Pledge Week and we need your support. You can support us by going to kfai.org and clicking on the Pledge Now button, or you can do that with your smartphone app, or you can call 612-375-9030. We're speaking with Melissa Allman. Melissa is an advocacy and government relations specialist for the CNI. So I want to talk about the U.S. Department of Transportation's ruling on the travel by air with service animals. This has seemed to be flipped around a lot in the past couple of years with what we need to do, what we don't need to do. So why did they feel there was a need to decide to change things up?
That is an excellent question. So really the reason was that in recent years, since the last Department of Transportation regulations were implemented, more and more people have been traveling by air with animals to mitigate their disabilities. And so at the previous regulations protected, it covered emotional support animals and service animals. But given the proliferation of people traveling with animals to mitigate their disabilities, it became clear to the Department of Transportation, and I think air carriers would feel this way, and I think many service animal handlers would say that they're just, the law was confusing. And there were some nuances and that were not sort of accounting for the changes in sort of the way people were traveling with their animals. And it was difficult for air carriers to determine whether or not service animals were actual service animals. And if they were emotional support animals, were they going to be able to withstand the travails and trials of air travel? Were they trained to do that? So that's why the Department of Transportation said, okay, we're going to come up with some regulations that clarify a lot of this. And they took a while, but it was last year at the beginning of 2020 when they issued their notice of proposed rulemaking that included their proposed rule. And they asked for comments and gave us 60 days. And boy, did we have a lot of comments, because there were things in there that were of great concern to many of us. And then we waited a while at while they reviewed our comments and, and agreed and decided on a final rule, which became effective on January 11th of this year.
All right. So let's dig into what that rule was. And by the way, I deliberated whether I was going to comment or anything, but yes, and I know there were a lot of people traveling with animals that were not what they said they were. And that was a problem. And we saw that in the airport plenty of times with my service dog, and I saw that. Okay. So let's dig into the meat of this and talk a little bit about what this is. What do you have to do to now travel with a service animal?
So there are a lot of really significant changes in the rule, and some of them, I think it depends on who you are, whether you're a service animal handler, whether you're an air carrier, about how you feel about the changes, but it's sort of a mixed bag. We got some things that people are happy about and some things that people aren't. There are things that the airlines are allowed to do, and there are things that are just, this is the way it is, this is mandated. So, for example, now a service animal is a dog that is individually trained to perform a task for the benefit of a qualified person with a disability, regardless of breed or type. So the airlines that were getting away with imposing breed restrictions and DOT wasn't technically allowed, but they weren't really doing a whole lot about it.
Right.
At that point. That is definitely a no-no at this point. They're not allowed to do that. However, in the past, a service animal or emotional support animals were covered, and they didn't have to be dogs. Now they all have to be dogs, and they must be trained to perform a task. So that means no more cats, no more whatever other animals people might need to feel that they need to
ferrets.
Find. Ferrets. Now it's just dogs, and it is the dog must be trained to perform a task. Now, this does include psychiatric service animals. That was something that people who work with psychiatric service animals were really concerned about, that they were going to be, because they've been sort of lumped in with emotional support animals before.
Yes.
So airlines are now allowed to classify emotional support animals as pets. And most airlines are choosing to do that.
And so, I need to stop you just a minute, because I want you to give the definition so people who don't understand the difference between emotional support and psychiatric service dogs.
Absolutely. So a psychiatric service dog is trained to perform a task to mitigate, to assist, to benefit a person with a psychiatric disability. And the thing is that many times those disabilities are invisible disabilities. Our disability as blind people, we are people who travel with our guide dogs, and we're holding onto the harness, the dog's guiding us. Usually that's pretty obvious. But someone whose dog is mitigating an invisible disability, that task may be crucial to the person, but it may not be obvious to everyone what it is. So that is where it would get a little bit confusing for people. But an emotional support animal is different because its mere presence mitigates the disability. It doesn't have to be trained to perform a task, and it does not have to be trained to behave necessarily in public. That's not one of the things that is focused on with emotional support animals.
Okay. Okay. Carry on. Sorry.
Okay. No, that's quite all right, because there's a lot. So,
yes.
So what do you have to do now to be able to travel with your service animal? It's different. It used to be that you didn't really have to disclose. If you were traveling with something like a guide dog, you could just show up that day to fly, and you could disclose in your reservation if you were going to be asking for accommodations, you could disclose that you were traveling with a guide dog, but you didn't have to. You did if there was a need for documentation. But now, no matter who you are traveling with a service animal, airlines are allowed to require that you complete a form that is, it's the service animal air transportation form is what they're calling it. And you are attesting to the animal's health, behavior, and training on the form. Now, the airlines are required to make the form accessible and fillable on their websites. If they're going to require it, they're supposed to do that. We've worked very hard in the last couple of months to work with the airlines to try to get them to make the forms accessible. I'm on the legislative and advocacy committee of Assistance Dogs International North America, and together we've worked really hard to try to get the airlines to make those forms accessible, and there has been a lot of progress. There are a couple of airlines who are still a little bit behind, but that's one requirement. The airlines are allowed to require the form either at the gate in hard copy, or they can require it up to 48 hours in advance. So, you know, presumably in most cases that just ends up being electronically.
I'm going to stop you just a minute again.
Yeah.
So are all the things the same on every form, on this form?
Great question. The airlines are required to use the standard U.S. Department of Transportation, and airlines who are still working on making their form accessible, they are starting to refer people. The Department of Transportation has a sample accessible, fillable form on their website. So there's one airline I know that is sending people there to use that form, which is fine because it's exactly the same. It's a standard form.
If you were not able to fill it out 48 hours in advance, could you actually take the form, print the form, and have a person in the airport help you fill it out before you went to the gate?
Another really great question. So one thing I didn't say yet, and I want to make sure I do say, is if you have one of the emergency situations or spur of the moment situations where you've made your reservation less than 48 hours in advance, they have to just take the form at the gate. But to your point, if an airline is requiring that you do it 48 hours in advance and you don't, they are still supposed to try to accommodate you. And if you are, especially if you are someone who is unable, because not everybody has a computer, not everybody's tech savvy,
right,
and not everybody has access to those things. So the airlines are required to make an accommodation for you if you need them to, and assist you to fill the form out, as long as it doesn't cause an undue burden. So if you get to the airport 15 minutes before your flight and you want them to help you fill out the form, they could probably say no because you're going to delay the flight. Mm. But if not, they should be making an accommodation and assisting you to complete the form. There really isn't a way for you to call the reservations desk ahead of time and do that because they want you to sign it. And there is an accessible way to sign that. You can just type in your name in a signature box. But I think that's one of the reasons that's an issue. But yes, they're supposed to provide that accommodation
on that form. And that presumably that form is standard to all airlines, but maybe not accessible at all airline websites.
But it's required to be. And most airlines are coming into compliance with that.
Are there other forms that need to be filled out?
The only other form that needs to be filled out, if your flight is 8 hours or longer, there's a relief attestation form that you have to fill out, basically saying that your dog will either can relieve in a sanitary way that you can clean up and manage, or does not need to relieve itself during that flight. It's not a both and, it's an either or, unless you choose to provide both. And again, that is also a standard form.
So what happens if you know your dog is sick and you have to go on this flight and you don't think that they'll do anything, but if an accident happens?
So I think accidents can always happen, and the regs don't really address that. I think that's a situation where if you think you need a backup, you want to put on there that you think you have a sanitary way to manage that and say what that is. But then it just comes down to a practical matter of, if I know that my dog is sick before I leave, do I need to kind of rethink my plans a little bit for the best welfare of my dog as well.
Mm. Yes. So there's all these things that you have to fill out with this form. Talk about, you know, do you still have to take, you used to have to take your dog to the vet to get a wellness checks type thing. Do you still have to do that?
Well, you didn't have to do that in order to fly. You didn't have to, there wasn't a regulation that allowed airlines to require necessarily that you do that. Although some airlines were asking you to carry your rabies vaccine and there was nothing that precluded them from doing that. So all you have to do really is attest to the fact you have to provide your veterinarian's name and phone number, the training organization's name and phone number. You don't have to get them to sign anything on the form. You have to provide the dog's vaccination date and the date the vaccine expires.
Ah, but you don't have to, excuse me, you don't have to carry the rabies certificate with you?
You don't, but it's always, not according to the regulations, but it's always a good idea to do that anyway, because you never know when you might need that when you travel. But the regulations don't say that you have to. The form also says that you can be charged for damages if your dog damages anything, and you and airlines would have a practice of charging for damages in similar circumstances. And the form does ask you to attest that everything you're saying on there is true. It does ask for the name of your dog, but the transportation department has something on its website that talks about how airline employees should not use the dog's name so that it won't be distracted. But
what
they
if
do
we don't give them the name, or if we give them a fake name?
I think if there's any part of the form you don't complete, that could raise a red flag for the airline. It's also possible that they just won't pay attention. But they could say you need to fill in this information. And someone asked me if I put a different name on there that isn't my dog's actual name. Well, you know, if something happens and there's a behavior issue, because you also have to say on the form that your dog is not aggressive and doesn't have a history of biting and so on and so forth. So if there was an incident and the dog that your vet had on file wasn't the dog that you mentioned on the form, that could raise some questions. Would it necessarily come up? It's really hard to know, but they do ask for the dog's name.
Why do you feel that that's so important for that? Because a lot of us don't like to give out our names. You know,
I don't feel that it's important, that it's just, that's what they have decided to do with their form. And I think that their reason is because they want to link the dog to the information. If
I see,
in fact, they need to verify things. So for example, there is an airline that is deciding that they are going to reach out to training organizations if they do get one of these forms and say, can you verify that you are really the training organization?
Ooh, somebody's got time.
They're allowed. They're allowed to do it, and they've done it. And so that's another situation where that could come up if the name that's given isn't the same.
I see. Okay. When someone comes to Seeing Eye matches, for anybody who doesn't know, guide dogs with individuals, and they stay there for a certain time and they go home. What do you guys do then when the person is going home to kind of help them? How do you guys, you know, help expedite this process when the person's getting ready to leave?
Well, that's a really good question, because we haven't been doing this very long. So our strategy right now is to offer to assist in any way that we can with the form, with the completion of that. And a lot of times people don't know some of the information on that form a few days before they leave. So we do whatever we can to assist with that process. And if the student decides that they would like to do the form themselves, and they have a computer on which to do that, or they want to use one of our computers, of course, we provide them with an accessible copy of the form, but we are there to make it as easy as possible for the students that are getting ready to take this first big flight home with their doctor.
So another concern I would have is in my training, although they didn't, I'm not sure that they focused on this last time I was there, but previous, they really did kind of emphasize if you can at all help it to put your dog under the seat and to not sit necessarily in the bulk area. And I understand, you know, bigger dogs, you kind of have to do that because they may not fit under the seats are getting smaller and smaller, the area in front of them or under them. Do you feel like, excuse me, that people are having trouble with the airlines changing their seats to the bulk area if they tell them they're bringing a guide dog and they've chosen their seat already and they don't want to sit in that area? So
that's a really good question. I think that that continues to be an issue that comes up. I know I've experienced it, and sometimes I'm okay with the bulkhead depending on how the bulkhead is shaped. If it's one of those ones where it's there's all this space and there's room for her to kind of go under the bulkhead, then that's fine. But if it's one of those skinny bulkheads where she has to turn sideways and go into the foot space of a neighboring passenger, then I'm not so thrilled about it. And I will say that the regulation has not changed concerning bulkheads. You can ask for a bulkhead as an accommodation, but if it's not the seat you purchased, you can't be forced to sit there. That has not changed. What the new regulations do say is that they make it very clear that your dog has to fit in your foot space. So that's the space in front of your seat. And in our case, it would be putting our dogs under the seat. And also, by the way, you're allowed to have two service animals, so you could also have one on your lap. That's just what the regulations say. But they also say that if your dog is a large breed, the airline is supposed to be making an effort to accommodate you if your dog doesn't fit, either by offering you a space where your dog will fit, another seat, or a seat next to an empty seat or next to somebody who doesn't mind sharing foot space. That has not really changed. But they do make it, I mean, they say that for large breeds, there is supposed to be an attempt to make that accommodation. And what they were proposing was pretty negative. And so we're glad that they gave a little bit on that. But they don't have to offer you a seat that is in a class above what you purchased, unless they want to, but they sure don't have to.
But they can't say that's the only seat we have to offer to get your dog to fit. Now you have to pay the upgrade. Can they?
No. If they're gonna make you sit, if they're offering that as an accommodation, they should not be charging you extra for that. If you're saying I want to be there because my dog has more room, then you would have to pay for that. But if they're saying this is how we're going to accommodate you, I would argue that they shouldn't be charging extra for that.
Okay. How does somebody, if they're having trouble with filling out forms and maybe getting pushed back from whatever there is happening with their service animal at the airport, how can they advocate for themselves?
Excellent question. So let's just say you're being forced to sit in that bulkhead that you don't want to sit in because you didn't buy that seat, you deliberately didn't buy that seat, or you get to the airport and you need assistance filling out the form and they say no. Any of these things, you can ask to speak to a complaints resolution official, a CRO, and a CRO is someone who will resolve, who will try to come up with a resolution to discrimination complaints, and they are required to provide you with one. And if they say, we don't have CROs, which I've actually heard that happen, but if they say, there isn't one available today, which there is always one available. So if that happens, then that's another discrimination, that's another violation. And if you're not satisfied with the resolution that the CRO reaches, or you can do this anyway, but definitely if you're not satisfied with that, then you can file a complaint with the Department of Transportation.
So if they say, sorry, we don't have a crow available today, then we should presume that's probably false, that there always is one?
Correct. They have to make one available to you either on site or via phone. So they could hand you a cell phone and say, here's the crow, but they have to make one available.
Ah.
Now, one area where this kind of gets dicey is like if the doors are about to close or something.
Yes.
That they can then say, they may be able to say, it'll have to be after we land. And that doesn't mean just because you can still pursue the discrimination complaint after your flight. There's no requirement that it be right then. There's also an FAA hotline that you can call, and there's information about that on our website. And they can sometimes facilitate resolutions, but they're available between 9 and 5, Monday through Friday. So you have to be flying during that time.
But also, though, if it's a seating difficulty, you probably have to do what they ask you to do.
Yeah, it can get complicated. Sometimes, though, when you ask for a crow, one of the things that has happened to people is when they ask for a crow, sometimes the problem magically goes away because the airline doesn't want to have to get a crow. So that happens.
So you say as long as you can get, if you can't fill out the form in 48 hours and have to do an emergency flight, if you can get that in or get that to the gate before you have to get on the plane, it's acceptable?
So what the regulations say is that if you make your flight, if your flight reservation is made less than 48 hours before the flight, then the airline is not allowed to require the form in advance and has to accept it at the gate.
Ah, okay. And accept it meaning that it should all be filled out, a blank form.
It should be, but if you need assistance, you can ask for an accommodation. One of the things that's hard about the form is that only one airline that I'm aware of has an HTML version of it. It's in Adobe, so you have to download Adobe in order to complete the form, and it's free. Adobe is free, but if you open it up in your browser, the form may not look accessible. So you've got to open it in Adobe, which maybe others have a great way of doing this, but I've not figured out how to do that on my phone and get it to be fillable on my phone. And so that's why we're really trying to encourage airlines to go to an HTML format, which some of them are working on, and that's a process.
When you fill out these forms, how long are they good for?
Another really good question. The regulations say that it's per reservation. So the airlines are allowed to require that you complete the form each reservation, not each leg of your trip. So if it's a round trip and it's one reservation, you should only have to do the form once. Now, there are a couple of airlines that are allowing you to use the same form within a certain time frame. So Alaska Airlines, as long as your vaccine has not expired, you have an ID that they, a profile that they help you create or that you can create using their website. And so then your form is good until your dog's vaccine expires. And American Airlines is letting you do that for up to a year. As we know, some of us have 3-year rabies vaccines. So that can be helpful.
It does get hard having airlines, though, have all these different, you know, you can do this for this long, or another airline, you can do this for this long, or we'll keep your form for this long. You know, you just don't know. How do you know?
Well, so what I would say is that I agree with that, and that anytime you fly, it's important to go to your airline, the airline that you've chosen, go to their service animal policy, and look at it. They make it pretty clear on their websites what they expect. So that is one thing that I encourage everyone to do. Fly. Go to that airline's website, see what they're doing, and know that before you go.
I want to talk about flying out of the country. Are there different forms that you have to fill out if you're going to fly not within the, you know, out of the U.S.?
So if you're flying, airlines can require the forms if there's a point in the U.S. So if you're flying, maybe you're flying somewhere else, but you start out in the U.S. or you end in the U.S., they can require the forms. Once you're outside the U.S., and like, let's just say you're flying from one point to another point outside the U.S., then you want to know the regulations of those countries.
How do you find that out?
So you can find that out. You know, one way to find that out is by, you want to make sure you know the import and export requirements for your dog. And the USDA is a good source for those types of things in terms of health requirements. And if there are any tests that your dog needs to have, like a rabies titer test or anything like that. And if you really, if you have questions about these things, you can also contact the consulate of the country that you're traveling to. And you can, if you're a graduate of the Seeing Eye, you know, one of the things we get a lot of questions about international travel, and we can, if you want to reach out to advocacy@seeingeye.org, we can provide and as we have it about the export, import and export requirements in those situations.
So this ruling that has just been established pretty much is subject to change, actually. It's only good for X amount of years. Am I correct?
That's not my understanding. I don't think that we're looking at it changing anytime soon. There have been some conversations about possible strategies that some organizations are considering for what could we do to get this overturned, and whether or not they are successful with that is something that I am just not really sure how that's going to go.
I had thought maybe they were going to relook at it in like 2023 or something.
They could do that, but I think for now, these are the regulations that we're dealing with.
Does the Seeing Eye feel that there should, you know, be something saying that guide dogs are exempt from these forms at all?
What I can say is that we are looking into strategies to try to make this as easy for guide dog handlers as possible. And we are continuing to dialogue with the airlines about those issues. I will say that we're very aware that for over 90 years, there have been guide dogs in the US, and we have been traveling with our dogs for many, many years since Morris Frank took that first flight on United without forms, without some of these burdens that have now been placed on us. And we are exploring those issues very closely.
And I think I would argue on the other side, though, that it seems like, at least in my thoughts, that it's not necessarily that they're trying to punish the guide dog users, but, or the service dog users, but that it's all the others that kind of ruined it, or are bringing things in that they shouldn't bring in, or lying about it, or be doing fraudulent stuff. And it's kind of like, where do you draw the line? What do you do to implement something that at least helps take out some of the riffraff?
Well, I think that's something that I think that that's how a lot of the airlines are feeling at this point. I think that's their perspective. And I would also say that I think there are guide dog handlers, and I'm not speaking for anyone. I just know that there are some guide dog handlers that don't feel like the forms are a big deal and are perfectly willing to fill them out. I've heard from a lot more people that are upset about the forms. But there are definitely some who are sort of like, hey, I don't mind. It's just, it's not that big of a deal, and I'll have less interference in the airport, presumably. So just, it's interesting because our community, there are mixed views on this, even within our community.
And are they upset because it's not accessible all across the board all the time? Or are they upset because nobody should be questioning me?
So first of all, the other thing I would say too is that I would agree with you that I don't think the airlines set out to punish guide dog handlers. I don't think that that was their goal. And I think people are frustrated, really frustrated about the lack of accessibility. Again, that has improved dramatically since January 11th. So, but it's still not, it's still a work in progress, and it, and the regs do require it. So people are very frustrated about that. And then I think other people are frustrated because the, because that was not a burden that was imposed on us before, and now it is. And you, and our dogs, of course, they're not perfect, but they are trained to behave appropriately in public.
But for me, I can't tell you how many times somebody's dog has jumped off their lap and started yapping at my dog, or somebody's dog has popped their head out and sent me jumping in the air as a startling, you know, because yep. they had it in their purse or whatever it yep. was.
And yeah, I'm right there with you in terms of concerns about, I mean, I think that one of the things that's good about these regulations is they make it very clear what types of behaviors are grounds for
right.
not being allowed to travel with your animal. And I actually, one airline employee had a really interesting way of saying this. She said, one of the things that they sometimes say is, your dog, we cannot classify your dog as a service animal today based on the behavior that we are seeing. We're not trying to say that this is not a service animal, but this behavior is not going to allow us to have you fly this dog in the cabin. Growling, jumping, lunging,
right,
eliminating in the airport. They're very clear about the types of behaviors.
Gotcha. Is there anything else that we should know about traveling with guide dogs?
I think that what the best thing to do is to educate yourselves. All of us, we have to make sure that we know what our rights are, and we have a summary of the regulations and links to them, and also to the accessible form on our website at cei.org/access. So, and then you can go from there to airlines and cruise ships, and that has all of the information. You can also reach out to advocacy@cei.org. That's our advocacy email address. Another thing that I did not say about these regulations that's important to know is that our dogs must be leashed, tethered, or harnessed at all times. So just make sure that that is the case. Of course, we take our harnesses off. Most of us take them off and have our dog be under the seat. But of course, the leash should always still be on. And that's something that the regulations are very clear about now.
So I want to make sure that I touch on this again, because I feel like maybe I wasn't clear enough, because if you are having trouble filling out the form, you can go to an accessible place and fill it out, print it, and bring it in. On who would you give that to exactly?
So what I would say is that I want to stress, though, that airlines are allowed to require the form 48 hours, up to 48 hours in advance. And if you are not able to do that, you would request an accommodation, and you would go to the gate agent and ask for assistance filling that out. I think that it's going to be a learning curve. I think that gate agents are not used to providing that kind of assistance, and they're overwhelmed. So if right. they can't do it, they have to find, you know how busy it gets at the gate.
Oh, yes.
You know? So if the gate agent can't do it, then I think the question is which airline employee can. Now, I think what they don't want, though, is for everybody to be saying, oh, well, I couldn't do the form. And then you get people just lining up asking to do the form at the gate. I think there needs to be, I think there's an expectation that there needs to be a good faith effort to do it up to 48 hours in advance if you've made your reservation early, assuming the airline's website allows for that. But if you can't and you need that accommodation, they are supposed to be making an effort to make that accommodation. There are some airlines actually that don't have a way of uploading your completed form yet. So they're just saying, bring it to the gate.
That's what I was saying. If you did print out the form and got it filled out beforehand, you could bring it and just hand it to them filled out.
Yes. Yes, you could. And, or if the airline has a way of doing it, like there is one airline that's having you email it to them.
Ah.
So there's one airline, only one, that has an HTML form that you can fill out. But a lot of them don't have a way of capturing the data yet. So I would encourage everyone, regardless of what the airline is doing, just bring a copy of the form with you anyway, that all filled out. And even if you can't fill it out on your phone, you can, once you have filled it out, you can probably open it up on your phone. Several airlines have said, if you don't have a printer, because when I'm on out somewhere, I don't have a printer.
Right.
So you are able to also, if you don't have a physical copy, you can pull it up on your phone and they will accept it that way as well.
Melissa, thank you so much for joining us.
This has been really, really fun. I really appreciated the opportunity. And of course, you know how to reach us if you have any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great night.
We have been speaking with Melissa Allman. Melissa is an advocacy and government relations specialist for the Seeing Eye Guide Dog School. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Annie Harvey is my engineer and Charlene Dahl is my research woman. And it's Pledge Week. It's our last week for a while for pledging. So please get your pledge in at kfei.org/support or 612-375-9030. And Annie, I think we need to hear another clip.
We sure do. We have some clips from DHS from a previous show that we're about to roll. Thank you.
And I want to talk about income levels. You know, I think right now it's really difficult. People's income is being affected. Many, many companies have figured how to have people work from home, but not all. And some companies have folded and some people have been laid off. Actually, a lot of people have been laid off. So what happens in the sense of if somebody's already in affordable care housing or affordable housing and they lose their job, and what happens with that whole rent thing, and how is this affecting everyone, and what protections do they have?
Yeah, this is Rachel. So we're talking in early December, and we know that a lot of households have lost income. They've lost formal income, so they lost their job due to COVID that was wage paying, and maybe they've had access to unemployment insurance. But as of today, we don't know of any extensions, and a lot of those programs are running out of time. And people also earn income in informal ways, maybe caring for a neighbor's kid or doing some odd jobs, driving for one of these app services. And there are fewer protections for those households, certainly. I did just get I'm so fortunate to have at my fingertips, our research team reminded me that we have 100,000 households, both renters and homeowners in Minnesota, who are very low income. So that's sort of the poverty line and below, very low income, where there's a member of the household who has a disability. And of those households, of those 100,000 households, person with disability and very low income, over 75% of them are what's considered cost burden. So already before the pandemic, they were paying 50% or more of their household income toward their housing costs. So we already had some really serious issues that households were facing in Minnesota, and the pandemic has really emphasized. In terms of the protections, what are the safeguards? Fortunately for the lucky few who are living in some kind of subsidized Section 8 type development, those Section 8 vouchers adjust for household income. Yep. And so there are some protections and safeguards built in. But for most people, that isn't how their rent works. Rent is rent, and rent has to be paid. Or house payments, association dues, property taxes, utilities, they have to be paid. So we've had in place in Minnesota since early in the pandemic an eviction moratorium at the state level. There's also a CDC federal eviction moratorium. So we are not seeing a lot of evictions. There are very few and in limited circumstances that are moving forward. But we also know the rent is still due. You may not be able to be evicted for not paying, but the rent is still due and that households are very behind. So again, we're talking in early December. We've just wrapped up Minnesota Housing had access to $100 million of federal CARES Act funding that we used for an emergency housing assistance program specific to COVID. The federal rules, the money runs out at the end of December 2020. We don't control that, but we also were able to use, we saw households access all $100 million. That does put a real point on what we are facing in Minnesota, that we, in a short few months, we just started this in the fall, used $100 million to help people catch up on missed payments where they were already behind. So we know that going into 2021, resources, support to keep people housed is going to be critical. We need more help with the safeguards. There's lots of advocacy happening on that front. We hope it's successful. It is certainly easier to keep people housed and support them in place than it would ever be to recover from a wave of evictions or a wave of housing loss. That would be truly devastating. And so we're continuing to work hard at the state level, federal, local advocates to push for support for people so that we don't see housing loss. We've been fortunate this far, but we have a ways to go.
Can you tell me?
Oh yeah, go ahead.
How long the eviction moratorium is in place for?
So my understanding, I hope I get this right, but that the federal does end this month, and this is a CDC federal moratorium, but the state of Minnesota eviction moratorium is more comprehensive. Mm-hmm. And so it supersedes the federal, but the state of Minnesota is paired with the governor's state of emergency. And so it has continued with each renewal of the state of emergency.
And certainly we're seeing cases rise. So the idea that if it ends federally this month, we sorely need something to be reactivated or something.
Yeah, we certainly do. I watch the news every day. I'm sure that we all are, in hopes that some additional, both at the state and federal level is where we may have the opportunity to see more resources come through. We are standing by. If we had more housing assistance to help households, we would absolutely mobilize and work on getting that out the door.
How have you had to change how housing services are being delivered because of COVID-19?
Yeah, this is Gertrude. So since the pandemic began, we have really worked closely with housing providers across the state to make it easier for them to provide critical services. And so the state has invested really significant amounts of money to make this possible. There was a $5.5 million appropriation to increase housing support payments this spring. Mm-hmm. And this helped over 20,000 adults keep their housing. There was another $26 million appropriation that helped with homeless shelters to help them respond to the pandemic. And the other thing that we did was to temporarily lift paperwork, which we viewed as burdensome, to make it easier for people in sudden financial crisis to get assistance without having to go to their county or tribal office in person. And so these are some of the things that we're doing on our end because we are on, once again, on that income support side, to make the services, housing services, available to people in a safe way.
All right. And we are back. And Charlene, are you still with me?
Yeah, oh, Shirley.
Ah, excellent. So I forgot about that show. That was a good, was an important show. And I really enjoyed this one too. I hope you have enjoyed it and hope all that are listening out there have enjoyed it. And Annie, I bet you're still there. And you guys have just 4 more minutes or so to get in before the end of this hour for pledging for us. And I think Daniel is still on the phone for 4 minutes. And 612-375-9030. And I know I made my pledge while this was playing, because it was just so convenient to call in there and say, hey, take my credit card. But we do definitely can use and need your support. And if you value the info that you hear each week that we bring you, then please show your support by going to kfai.org/support or clicking on your button in your smart app, or by calling 612-375-9030 for just a couple minutes more. But you could probably call tomorrow too and specify that you wanted to go to Disability and Progress. And I don't directly get your money, but the station sure does. And the station uses it for all sorts of great things. And I want to emphasize that we're working on the computers, but that the board, when I go in, when I do get to go in again to, you know, after COVID time to engineer my show, it is an accessible board. So I'm very proud of that. And I have, you know, there's things brailled on there. I don't know if the brailles remain. Maybe people have been so nervous. I may have to rebraille, but it is an accessible board, all these great slidey pods that you can do. So hopefully you will support the show. Furthermore, I do want to welcome people to join our podcasts. We do lots of podcasts. Please feel free to listen to those. And I want to thank also the people who sent in questions tonight for me to ask Melissa in regards to service animal travel. And you too, when you see a show coming up that you would like to respond and ask questions to, can always email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com and submit your questions. You can either do that for that, or you can get on our emailer, same email address, disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com, and ask to be put on the emailing list. And you'll get a list of shows that are coming up, and you can are always welcome to submit questions and ideas. I guess that's what I got for you for tonight. Charlene, do you have anything you'd like to add before we go?
No, thanks for listening. And if you can, keep us on the air with a little bit of spare change.
This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI, except for the pledging, or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Annie Harview is my engineer. Thank you to Mason for splicing the clips that we heard tonight. Thank you to also to Melissa Allman. Melissa is an advocacy and government relations specialist for the Seeing Eye, who we spoke with in detail about the traveling with service animals. This is KFEI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFEI.org. Thanks for listening. Good night.
KFAI.org.